You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Do you remember dissecting frogs when you were in school? Some schools today are opting for fake frogs instead. We'll find out why coming up. Right now, it's time for our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup, talking with reporters around the state about the stories they're covering. First, Caledonia and the city of Racine are rolling out new electronic voter books, starting with this month's primary elections. And Racine's city operations are working to recover from a ransomware attack earlier this week. Adam Rogan is state and national politics reporter for the Racine Journal-Times. Adam, good to have you back with us.
Hi, Rob. Always good to be here.
Let's start with these electronic voter books in a couple communities there. Why are officials saying they're switching over to those?
Well, I think that the reason that they're starting to look into these is they can just be so slow for a lot of poll workers to go through those big white binders to try to find everyone's last name. With these new poll books, they can just, you know, put in the last name and confirm, yeah, you're registered or no, you're not. And it's also faster to register. If you're going to register using the machines, you can just scan the barcode on your ID, whether it's the state-approved ID or a driver's license, and it will just autofill all that information, and there's less chance of errors of, you know, someone just typing it in.
With technology like this, people might worry about cybersecurity. What are they saying about steps being taken to protect these electronic voter rolls?
Yeah, the couple of municipal clerks I've talked to and staff around them they've all said, like, this is pretty much as safe as the paper would be because it's not connected to the internet. The servers they use for all the information are locally stored, so all the different local computers can talk to one another, but you couldn't, like, hack in from somewhere else. You'd have to actually be localized, and of course that's as vulnerable as, for example, a piece of paper.
And to be clear, this is just the part where you check in to vote. It is not, the ballot itself doesn't happen on these voter books, right?
Correct. The ballots here are going to be filled out the exact same way, filling in the little bubbles like the ACT test. This is just for checking in and to hopefully speed up the process and also keep it just as safe as before.
Now, another electronic technology-related story in your neck of the woods. The city of Racine was the victim of a ransomware attack this week. One of their departments, we've seen some other cases like this around the state. What's happening in Racine?
So right now, the city of Racine is slowly trying to get its systems back up to normal. A couple times this week, I've mistakenly sent emails to people who work for the city and then get them immediately bounced back because their email is knocked out. The voicemail is knocked out. A lot of their, like, internal systems, the behind-the-scenes stuff, hasn't been working. And so they've been doing a lot of stuff in paper again, kind of like the joke we've had is that they've been knocked back to the 1990s. But they're expecting, like, have their payroll, for example, back on Monday. And what they have to do is basically just rebuild their systems from scratch, not as they're recoding everything, but re-uploading something. They have their payroll back up. They just got to replace the old payroll. They have their emails back up. They just got to replace it. They're just kind of going one at a time, fixing all this stuff after they make sure they cleared out the viruses that have taken over the computers.
And this is one of those attacks where the hackers shut down your system and say they'll open it back up for you if you pay them. Is there any talk about whether Racine was considering paying to get their services back?
Well, oddly enough, this had all the marks of ransomware attack. They came in, they locked everything down, but Racine never got any contact from anybody saying, hey, we're demanding money. So at the moment, it seems like they just took it over and then maybe forgot to send the ransom, or Mayor Corey Mason a few days ago said even if they asked, they weren't going to pay it. And so maybe they saw the news story and said, well, we'll just give up on them, and then just left them locked and let the city rebuild itself. A similar thing happened in Oshkosh as well, of they got locked out and they're not paying and all. They just kind of got to slowly get everything back up to speed.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Glad to, Rob, anytime.
That's Adam Rogan, state and national politics reporter at the Racine Journal-Times. He talked to us about a ransomware attack, without the ransom apparently, on the city government there, and new electronic voter books being rolled out for this month's primary election. Now, a task force of students and faculty at UW-Eau Claire is making recommendations to the school following two incidents of racism from students late last year. Sarah Seifert is a reporter for the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a brief reminder of the events last year that ultimately led to the formation of this task force of students and faculty?
Sure. In November, there were several private social media messages between a group that were posted on Twitter. Those messages referenced the Ku Klux Klan. There was a photo of a burning cross posted. It also referenced a UW Eau Claire student group called Black Male Empowerment. And after those messages were made public, five student athletes were suspended from the UW Eau Claire football team. In another incident in September, a Native American student found a message that said, "Go back to the res," and a racial slur written on her dorm room door. University leaders condemned the incidents. The dean of students finished an investigation in December, and several students involved in the social media messages have received disciplinary sanctions.
And now what is coming out of this task force reviewing these issues, but as I understand, looking forward too?
Sure. The task force's first and primary recommendation is what they're calling a restorative justice program. And what that might look like is any UW Eau Claire student who is involved in misconduct might get an opportunity to take responsibility and help mend damage to the campus or to any other students or faculty or staff that were impacted. And that restorative justice is a part of what is being considered for the students who were sanctioned for these racist social media messages. That's something that the university has said on Wednesday.
And there, so this restorative justice might be in the works. No official word from UW Eau Claire on what punishments the students might or might not get?
Correct. The university has said that these students have been sanctioned. It has not said what those sanctions are, and they have not identified the students who were sanctioned either. They said they can't release that information under FERPA, the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act.
And have we heard anything from the task force or the university, for that matter, on, I guess, climate in the future for diverse students there?
Sure. The task force has said they have some other recommendations. They said restorative justice is partly what's being considered for these students, but they haven't definitively said that they plan to develop it as a program or if they're going to use all these recommendations. The university has plans for all new freshmen to go through diversity training starting this fall. That's another one of the task force's recommendations, is to fully implement that additional diversity training. They're also urging the university to update how students can report what they're calling bias or hate incidents. The university does have a system for students to report when something like this happens, but the task force has said that many students are poorly informed about the system. Students who might, you know, maybe submit a report will get an initial response, but they aren't guaranteed follow-up communication from the university. And so the task force kind of wants to close that communication gap.
Sarah, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Sarah Seifert is a reporter for the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram. She talked to us about recommendations from a task force of UW Eau Claire students and faculty after two racist incidents on campus late last year. Now, the Milwaukee County Board voted yesterday 14-3 to double its spending on voter registration and education ahead of the November elections. Corrine Hess is a WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. Corey, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the Milwaukee County Board voted yesterday, as you report, to double its spending on voter registration efforts. What were the reasons they gave to make this investment?
They're doing this because of the possible voter purge that's going to happen in the state. Right now, this has been tabled, but they want to get in front of this so that they can provide education and voter registration for people who aren't registered.
And what kind of efforts are we talking about here?
Well, Milwaukee County wants to do an advertising campaign. They did this in 2017. What they're hoping to do is put messages on county buses, bus stops, do ads in newspapers and on radio.
And three of the supervisors on the board voted against the spending increase. I understand. What were some of the objections they raised?
They did. Well, one of the objectives was the cost. Milwaukee County was going to spend $50,000 on this. Now they're spending $100,000. An extra $50,000 doesn't sound like a lot of money, but Milwaukee County is cash strapped. So the supervisors brought that up. Another thing was the three who objected, they don't believe that the voter purge is out to get anyone specifically. The supervisors who were supportive said that this is targeted at people of color. The other supervisors, they said that that's not the case, that this is just being done to help out county clerks.
Now, this is all happening, of course, in 2020 with a big presidential election, congressional elections and more. Did people reference kind of the importance of this year's elections in particular in arguing for or against this spending?
Oh, they sure did. They talked about the importance of Milwaukee in this election. You know, Wisconsin overall is going to be an important state with the presidential election. And the people who supported this talked about Milwaukee's votes counting. Milwaukee is predominantly Black, and they said that they want to make sure that the Black vote gets out. And they wanted to make sure that every vote counts.
All right, Corey, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date on that.
Thanks for having me.
Corinne Hess is a WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. She talked to us about a vote by the county board there to double spending on voter registration efforts ahead of the next election. She finished out our Wisconsin News Roundup. Coming up, we'll look into the debate over whether to have high school students dissect real frogs or cut into fake ones, which is a thing now. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, President Trump celebrated his acquittal yesterday, and some in the GOP are moving to investigate Hunter Biden. We'll break down some of the latest national news with a UW-Madison political scientist. First, think back to middle school or high school biology class. Do you remember dissecting frogs, the smell, the feel, the guts? Maybe you had some moral reservations about having to do it or thought it was kind of yucky. Fewer kids are sharing that in that experience today, not because there's less dissection going on, but because more educators are turning to fake frogs and other animals. The synthetic versions are seen as more humane and an antidote for squeamish students. Some schools are even opting for digital dissections on screens or with virtual reality headsets. But are students being robbed of messy real-life science? Tonnell Hobbs is the national K-12 education reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Tonnell, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, until I read your piece, this is news to me. I didn't know this was even a thing, these synthetic dissection animals. Tell us what's out there.
You know, the synthetic frogs, which are called syn frogs, S-Y-N frogs, as in synthetic, they rolled out and I guess they made their debut in November, but they are getting so much attention right now throughout the country. There are just some, you know, science teachers that feel like, well, you know, this kind of could address the animal welfare concerns. It could take out the ick factor of dissections, and it could also preserve real frogs. So there's all kind of arguments for doing it, and there's arguments now, to not do it, too.
Yeah, in writing this up, you talked to some teachers and some students. What kind of things did you hear from students who worked with these versus the real thing?
You know, the students really liked the synthetic frog, and really the reason why they liked it, because it didn't have that strong smell, you know, the formaldehyde smell. So they did like that. There was a couple students that had never even dissected a real frog, so they thought it was cool anyway. But one of the students I talked to, in comparison of the two, she did like the fake frog because it didn't smell as bad.
Now, I was a terrible dissector. There was no hope for me with, I think, a real or fake frog. But you mentioned there's some opposition to this, a concern that if you're using these frogs that are always perfect, you don't get a sense of how messy and various life can be.
Exactly. And that's what some science teachers are saying. There's just no way they would use a synthetic frog because, you know, like they said, if it's synthetic, they're all the same, whereas a real frog, you know, they might have an extra limb or extra lung, or there might be some, you know, eggs in there if it's a female. So they kind of like that there's so many differences with the real specimens.
Now, from a cost standpoint, is there, I have no clue on this, is there a big difference between real frogs and these new syn frogs?
Yes, and see, the syn frogs, and that's another issue, the syn frogs cost $150. But they let you, there's some kind of plan where you can recycle up to five times or something like that. Or the one, included in the 150 is like five times the recycle, which it averages about $25 a frog, I guess. But the real specimen, they average about $8 to $10. So it is cheaper. But like I said, schools or teachers that are interested in going to the synthetic frogs, it's more than just money they're looking at.
And you also talked to some animal rights groups. They're, I'm guessing, pretty happy with this. What kind of things did they have to say?
Oh, well, they are so happy. They are so happy with it. PETA actually, they help. They're one of the funding partners of the synthetic frog. But, you know, they just like the parts that, you know, it helps preserve the real frogs, the ones in the wild and the ones who are, you know, lab bred. And even like this, the main synthetic lab that's doing these things, they're actually even doing synthetic cats, too, called copycats. So for schools that actually do dissections of, you know, cadaver cats, they can, you know, get the synthetic ones now.
Talking to Tonnell Hobbs with the Wall Street Journal. She reports on education around the country there, looking at a high school rite of passage or junior high biology class, maybe dissection. But now there are fake frogs, synthetic frogs, and other animals that some classes are turning to. And Tonnell, in the piece that you wrote, some people talk about, hey, you know, medical schools are even doing this to supplement their dissections of cadavers. There are apparently synthetic humans they're using for medical school.
They are. That's not even uncommon anymore for them to use the synthetic human cadavers now. And I think that's what really kind of got the interest with some of the school teachers, because they knew this was going on in medical school. So they're like, why can't we, you know, have synthetic frogs and synthetic cats? So there's a lot of interest on this, like I said, throughout the country, but there's also a lot of debate.
Now, some schools allow students to opt out of dissection. In fact, less than a year ago here in Wisconsin, the Madison School District told teachers they had to provide an equally educational alternative for those students. Is this something, Tonnell, that you've seen other schools or districts wrestling with? What do we do when a student doesn't want to do this dissection that's part of the syllabus?
Yes, there's probably about 18 states that allow opt-outs. And what some school districts are doing, and in some states it's required, that if a student doesn't want to dissect, you know, a dead animal or frog, that you have to provide an alternative assignment. So that is going on. But, you know, I talked to a principal in Florida that they're using that synthetic frog, and she said usually they have students that will opt out, and the last time they dissected the synthetic frog, there were no opt-outs.
You talked to one, I think it was a biology teacher, who got creative with his sourcing for dissections and used, I think it was roadkill in his class?
Yes, yes. This teacher, he's in Colorado, and he actually does use roadkill. They dissect the roadkill, and then they do like a skeleton reconstruction of the roadkill. So for him, he said that synthetic, anything would just definitely not work out. They actually dissect fish, and then after the dissection, they fillet the fish and cook it. So in his case,
no formaldehyde there, I'm guessing.
No. So he's really definitely not supportive of the synthetic of frogs and animals.
One concern you heard from some teachers is that the students wouldn't take a fake frog as seriously as the real thing. What were some of the concerns there?
Yeah, that's what they felt. You know, I talked to a science teacher in Baltimore City, and he felt like his kids would not have, they would not have taken it seriously, and that they probably would have just started throwing the frog around because it's not real. You know, there was a situation in a school where they had they were dissecting some owl pellets, and the kids were very excited. This was in North Carolina. They were excited, and when the teacher handed out the owl pellets, come to find out they were synthetic, and the kids quickly lost interest. So there are some kids that still want the real thing.
All right, I'm trying to figure out what's the market for synthetic owl pellets. Like, why does that exist in the first place?
Well, you know, because it's how owls digest things. You could actually, if you look at their pellets, you could look for bones,
right,
or just other signs of what they've eaten.
I get that for the real thing. I don't know why you need to fake that one. But okay, more power to them. So does this, Tonnell, does this look like a growth industry, the synthetic animals, frogs, and as you said, other species for dissection in classrooms? Do you see this as something that probably more and more schools are going to at least consider?
I definitely do. Since I wrote that story, I've had so many school districts call me. Just, hey, you know, can we get a contact for Cindaver? That's the company. Or, you know, they just want more information about it. And the only question, obviously, is the cost, because at $150 a frog, even with the recycling, you know, some schools are really struggling and they can't afford that. But I have heard a lot of interest in Cindaver, the company that makes the frog. They strongly feel that this is going to be the new way to go, that more and more schools will just start using the synthetic frogs and animals instead of the real thing.
Bringing this to a more fundamental level, Tonnell, it seems like there is an agreement whether people like the synthetic animals or not. There is agreement about the value of dissection exercises to learn about biology. Across the board, I'm guessing that a lot of the teachers were on board with that, it sounds like.
Across the board, they are on board with that, definitely. You know, but it was interesting in doing this story because there's the teachers who just are really against banning the dissection of, you know, dead frogs or, you know, animals. I really heard from them the loudest. I mean, they, you know, they feel, well, actually, the ones heard from the loudest are the ones who are totally against dissection or anything. But there are a growing number of teachers who are speaking up because they are scared that more schools are going to really start banning the dissection of animals and frogs.
Tonnell, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Tonnell Hobbs is the national K-12 education reporter at the Wall Street Journal. We talked to her today about the debate over whether to have high school students dissect real frogs and other animals or these new on the market synthetic versions of animals made specifically for dissection in class. Love to hear your story. If you have a memory of dissections back in your own biology class days, or maybe you refused to do it for one reason or another, concern for animals or squeamishness. And for the biology teachers out there, love to hear from you, especially if you've given these fake frogs, for example, a try. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear your stories. Coming up, we'll talk about the latest out of Iowa after the Democratic National Committee chair is calling for some of the results to be re-canvassed. We'll fit that into the ongoing Democratic primary campaign and look at the United States post-impeachment trial. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on the morning show, there's a state Supreme Court race going on, and you can meet the candidates. All three primary contenders will join the show over the course of next week. It starts Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, President Trump celebrated his Senate acquittal yesterday in a more than hour-long speech from the White House. Here's a listen.
We've been going through this now for over 3 years. It was evil. It was corrupt. It was dirty cops. It was leakers and liars. And this should never, ever happen to another president, ever.
A number of prominent Republicans were there to celebrate with the president. Now there's news that some GOP lawmakers are starting an investigation into Hunter Biden and his dealings in Ukraine. Meanwhile, we still don't have a winner from Monday night's Democratic Iowa caucuses. Democratic National Committee Chair Tom Perez is calling for some of the results to be re-canvassed. David Cannon is professor of political science at UW-Madison. David, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Super busy national news week, which
oh
seems
goodness.
To happen a lot lately.
Yeah, this to have three sort of major events back to back to back with the State of the Union, Iowa, and the impeachment vote. Yeah, it was quite the week.
Well, let's start with our post-impeachment world now. And what do you make of what we heard from President Trump in this hour-plus celebration, he called it at one point yesterday?
Well, it really was pretty remarkable that he was just in true form in terms of criticizing everyone who was out to get him from his perspective, and thanking all of the people who stood by him and supported him. And so it's what we have come to expect from the president. We've, you know, seen this repeatedly over the last couple of years, where he singles out anyone for pretty harsh comment who stands in his way. And we saw that pretty dramatically yesterday.
I want to listen to a little more of the speech from the president yesterday. Here's a listen.
It was a disgrace. Had I not fired James Comey, who was a disaster, by the way, it's possible I wouldn't even be standing here right now. We caught him in the act. Dirty cops. Bad people.
Some observers have pointed out that it sounds like he is saying he fired James Comey, FBI director, to stop an investigation into him. Is that people have read that as an admission of obstruction of justice?
Well, right. And that's something already he had done earlier, and in fact was included in the Mueller report about with the Russia investigation and obstruction, that the firing of James Comey, you know, at the time he linked it to the pressure about Russia. And so that, again, is something we've heard before. And it's just, I think what was remarkable yesterday, it was just how intense it was and how he just, you know, went on and on and on with this. And I don't know if you saw just within the last couple of hours, but James Comey had an op-ed in the Washington Post where he, you know, said how upsetting that was yesterday to him personally, not so much what the president said, which he said, again, he expected that, but the reaction of the people in the room, that all of these people who, you know, he had known and trusted and, you know, good people, many of them, laughing and going along with this and not walking out when the president started to say these, you know, pretty outrageous things. And so it's a interesting sort of commentary on how people get just caught up in the group and behave in ways that they normally wouldn't.
Senator Mitt Romney notably voted to convict the president on one of the two counts of articles of impeachment. He apparently is no longer with that group. Can you talk about some of the blowback he's gotten?
Well, certainly he's been the target of a lot of the fire. And when he gave his speech on the floor of the Senate explaining that he was going to vote to convict the president on the first article of abuse of power, he said that it was the hardest decision he ever made. And he knew that he was going to receive a lot of you know, negative feedback from people that he, you know, respected and worked with. But he said he had to do it because of his sort of moral position and the oath that he took to be a neutral juror for this case. And so he said his religious views and his moral conscience dictated that he had to arrive at that decision. And so there have been people calling for kicking him out of the party and all kinds of other pretty bad things. But he's basically sticking to his position that he did the right thing.
Now, there you have Mitt Romney, Republican Party presidential candidate just in 2012, now ostracized by the Republican Party. As you read it, did Mitt Romney change or did the Republican Party change in those, what's been 8 years now?
Well, I think pretty clearly it's the Republican Party that's changed. The Republican Party has become the party of Trump. And the people who don't want to be associated with President Trump in the Republican Party exact a great price when they stand up to the president. And so pretty clearly on a whole range of issues, the president has moved the Republican Party in a different direction. And it really is a very different party than when Mitt Romney ran for president in 2012.
Are you anticipating impeachment being a big part of the presidential campaign this year? Talk about impeachment, what happened and what didn't happen.
I kind of think not. I think that this will, I suppose it depends on how much more comes out, you know, over the next few months. That, you know, I'm sure we'll hear from John Bolton. We'll probably hear from some other people as well. So I think it will reappear every now and then. I think that President Trump's, you know, conduct in general is going to be a big issue in the campaign. There's just a story today about how he charges Secret Service members $650 a night to stay in his hotels and his property when he travels, like to Mar-a-Lago. And so there'll be things like this that come out, I think, on a regular basis. So President Trump's overall character and conduct, I think, will be an issue. Impeachment itself, I don't think that, I mean, I think the Democratic candidates are going to move past this now. I think they'll focus on different things, to focus on health care, the economy, things that voters care more about than impeachment.
Talking to David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison, looking at the fire hose of national news this week. Let's turn, we may come back to some of these issues related to impeachment. Let's turn to the Democratic side of things and whatever happened in Iowa. I want to give a listen to former DNC chair Tom Perez explaining why he wants a re-canvass of some of the precinct results. Here he is talking on MSNBC last night.
There have been reports, and we've seen in the tabulation process, that there were some questions raised. There was an example of a precinct in Blackhawk County where I think 83 state delegate equivalents were apportioned to Deval Patrick, which was a clear error. And so we all care. We have a shared interest in making sure we have accuracy.
Well, can you talk about what you've seen in the last few days from this weird Iowa caucus outcome?
Oh, my goodness. That was a complete meltdown. It just was. Yeah, I think the only good thing to come from this is it probably means it's the last Iowa caucus we're going to see. I can't imagine them sticking with this 4 years from now. It seems to me it's really they need to move to a primary rather than a caucus, because on so many levels, it really the process just broke down, starting with the app that many of the precinct captains didn't have, couldn't get to work on their phones. Then the phone lines, which are supposed to be the backup plan, were jammed. They couldn't get through. And then all of the other reporting errors, things that the DNC chair just spoke to of just copying columns wrong over in spreadsheets. And so people end up getting delegates that shouldn't have gotten them. There was another thing that just was in the news today about this, about the satellite caucuses around the state and also out of state even, where Iowa voters participated for the first time in these satellite caucuses. And there were two sets of rules that were actually stated by the Iowa Democratic Party. One set of rules that they employed that gave Bernie Sanders an advantage, and the other official set of rules that wasn't used that would have given a few extra delegates to Mayor Pete. So it just was a complete breakdown in terms of having an election count work in a way that could be seen as you know, working the way it should be working.
Let's talk about the consequences of this now. Republicans were quick to say, hey, you guys can't run one state's caucus effectively. Why should voters count on you to run the country? This was kind of a easy own goal, as they say in the soccer world.
Well, yeah. I mean, one thing I think that listeners have to keep in mind is that the caucus, they have over 1,700 sites around the state, and it's basically a volunteer operation. So this is not like, you know, campaign professionals running this. These are people who are just everyday citizens who volunteer their time to try to make this work. And these are all people who, you know, were trying their best to make this work properly, but they just didn't have the assistance and the training they needed to pull it off. So one thing I think is important to remember is that this wasn't some kind of nefarious plot to undermine the election or anything like that. This was just people trying to do their best that didn't have the tools they needed to conduct the election properly.
And on the other hand, with consequences, is this something that's going to affect the overall delegate count when Democrats meet in Milwaukee this summer?
No, it really won't, because they only have 41 delegates at the convention in Milwaukee. And so that's almost exactly 1% of the total. And if you look right now at the state delegate equivalents, which is the official thing that the state party reports, Mayor Pete and Bernie Sanders are almost exactly tied. Buttigieg is ahead by like less than two delegates right now. And so that will translate into the same number of delegates to the Milwaukee convention. And so it really at this point doesn't matter so much how the last few delegates sort out. So even if they do have the re-canvass that people are calling for, it's not likely that anything is going to shift in a way that would affect the actual delegates to Milwaukee.
Talking to David Cannon of UW-Madison's Political Science Department, looking at some of the latest news in national politics. This week marked the end of the Senate impeachment trial to President Trump and confusion coming out of the Iowa Democratic caucuses and New Hampshire coming up a vote on Tuesday. You can join in at 800-642-1234 on either of those topic categories. Are you glad to see the end of the impeachment trial? What do you make of a move from Attorney General Barr to put in place more rules for politically sensitive federal investigations? If you caucused yourself in Iowa this week, what does it look like from where you're sitting? What are your reactions wherever you are to the Iowa caucus? What are you watching for in the primaries now as they start to roll in? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about two big stories in politics this week, President Trump's acquittal in the Senate impeachment trial and the aftermath, and no winner from the Iowa Democratic caucuses, some confusion there, and the ongoing Democratic primary season. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the confusion from the Iowa caucuses on the Democratic side? Do you like the idea of re-canvassing those, or in the scope of things, does it matter? What are your thoughts on President Trump, his statements since the impeachment trial ended? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. We'll go to your calls now. Mark is with us in Hartford. Mark, hello.
Hi. My comment slash concern, I guess I've seen a lot of people recently calling out the Democratic National Convention saying that we're going to wind up with a repeat that we did in the last election where, you know, somebody's going to be favored over Bernie Sanders, like people claim that Hillary was. And I just wonder if there's any, you know, potential legitimacy to that or if that's something that our guest may have noticed.
Mark, thanks for the call. That concern that the Democratic establishment puts its finger on the scale during the primaries, David.
Well, it certainly didn't happen in 2016 in terms of the actual outcome. The Hillary Clinton had a majority of the delegates on the first ballot, didn't need the votes of the superdelegates to put her over the top. The complaint from the Sanders supporters in 2016 was that most of the delegates or superdelegates, a huge proportion, and those are like the party insiders, were supporting Hillary Clinton. So that is true. And if those superdelegates had been decisive in nominating Hillary Clinton, then the Sanders supporters would have had a legitimate beef. But in fact, she did win a straight flat-out majority of the delegates, fair and square, through the primaries and caucuses. And so there really wasn't any, you know, anything that did affect the outcome of the election. Now, for this time around, I think the Bernie supporters are a little more nervous because there is some indication that this could be a deadlock convention, that we might not have a winner on the first ballot because there's such a divided field right now. And then with Michael Bloomberg jumping in on Super Tuesday a little bit, you know, later, and he's likely to do, you know, fairly well in some of those early primaries where he's, you know, spent already more than $200 million, it's possible we could end up going to Milwaukee and not having anyone with the majority of the delegates. And if that were to happen, for the first time since they've existed, the superdelegates could play a role. And chances are they wouldn't be enthusiastically behind Bernie Sanders, although some of them are this time. It's definitely not as lopsided as it was in 2016, where an overwhelming majority of them were behind Hillary Clinton. So it's an interesting question in terms of how that plays out. And the other thing that has some people on the other side of the political spectrum within the Democratic Party concerned are these polls right now showing that Bernie Sanders supporters are not likely to support the nominee from the Democratic Party unless it's Bernie Sanders, something like only low 50% range of the Bernie Sanders supporters right now in the primary are saying they will back the nominee, whoever it is. And that really worries other Democrats, because if Sanders is not the nominee and they end up not supporting the who ends up running against President Trump, that could pretty much assure President Trump's reelection.
Thanks, Mark, for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to David Cannon from UW-Madison. We'll go now to Nate with us in Madison. Nate, hello.
Hi. Well, as far as the caucus is concerned, I think it's going to go into the on its way into the ash bin of history.
But let's hope.
I really think you just emphasized a very important issue, which is Democrats have got to be educated to the fact that if they don't want another 4 years of the current occupant of the White House, they have got to get together. They have to decide that the priority is a replacement, and that's got to rise above all else. Otherwise, they're going to shoot themselves in the foot again.
Nate, thanks a lot for the call. And David, looking back at, you know, the close margins in some key states, including Wisconsin in 2016, People point toward a lot of reasons for Donald Trump's victory in those states. One is the idea that, hey, maybe some of these Bernie Sanders voters decided not to vote for Hillary Clinton, stayed home, voted for a third party, whatever. Is that something that could be decisive in key swing states if that happened again?
Well, absolutely. I think that is a real possibility, and especially if it ends up being a divisive convention where the Sanders supporters believe that he was unfairly treated at the convention, then you really could see a split within the party, the type of which Nate was saying we need to the Democrats need to avoid if they want to be able to beat President Trump. And I think that that's right, that a unified party is going to be necessary going into November for the Democratic Party.
Thanks for that call. Now, that said, David, there was talk, at this stage of the game of, are the Republicans going to end up with a contested convention? And that fell away. It's still pretty early yet, and a lot of people may slide out of that race, maybe even in the next few weeks.
Right. Yeah, I don't think there's going to be any serious opposition to President Trump on the Republican side. In fact, quite a few states have set up the primaries or caucuses where there won't even be anybody else on the ballot against him. And so in Iowa, turnout was very, very low on the Republican side. I think they had something like 30,000 people, like 32,000 showed up to vote on the Republican side, and President Trump got 97% of the vote or something. And so I think that's going to be typical of most of the primaries and caucuses around the country, that there won't be any serious opposition to President Trump on the Republican side.
Now, from a historical perspective, we used to have contested conventions all the time, and just doing some history reading is kind of cool. They made for a really wild story to follow. Would it be so bad if we went back to that?
Well, yeah, no, that's where the term smoke-filled room comes from. So, yeah, I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing. I mean, the last controversial convention the Democrats had was 1968 in Chicago with Hubert Humphrey's nomination and all the Vietnam War protesters outside. But Humphrey got that nomination having, being the incumbent vice president, having basically not entered very many primaries and caucuses because he jumped in pretty late. It was after the assassination of Robert Kennedy. And so Eugene McCarthy's supporters were the ones that time who were really upset that Humphrey could come in as the insider's choice and basically take the nomination. So that really did split the Democratic Party in 1968 and led to the election of Richard Nixon.
Let's bring on one more caller. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. As far as the unified party can sound good, but then with the Republicans, a lot of them weren't in favor of Donald Trump. But then when they dropped out, they went along the party line of supporting the front runner. Well, the front runner turned out to be bad news, which turned out to be bad news for all of them. So that could happen to the Democrats also.
Well, but ultimately the front runner, Donald Trump, ended up winning the election. So people have said, hey, what happened to Republicans with Donald Trump could happen to the Democrats with Bernie Sanders. And Donald Trump won. So would that be so terrible for Democrats?
So, yeah, I see what you're saying. So if the if everyone would unify behind Bernie Sanders as the candidate to run against Donald Trump, then that could work out the same way it worked out for Trump in 2016, potentially.
Massive hypothetical there,
say. Hypothetical, right. And that's certainly possible. And that's definitely the argument that the Sanders supporters are making, right, is that like Donald Trump in 2016, he galvanized a whole group of new voters that typically hadn't been voting that much in presidential elections and appealed to some independents, appealed to some disgruntled Democrats even. And Bernie Sanders supporters argue that he can do the same thing, that he can bring in a whole new group of voters that have been disaffected with politics and will be fired up by his campaign, and that will make up for losing some of those voters in the middle. That's the argument.
Thanks for that call. In our last few moments, David, New Hampshire primary just around the corner. What are you going to be watching for?
Well, I think the big question here is, can Joe Biden kind of resurrect his campaign? It was a big loss for Biden. I mean, the story coming out of Iowa that we haven't really touched on yet, I think Mayor Pete did much better than people thought he would. Really surprised, basically tying for first place with Bernie Sanders, where Sanders had been expected to win in Iowa, but then just Biden fading to number four, very weak showing there, and he is himself described it as a gut punch. And so I think Biden is not going to win New Hampshire. This is Bernie Sanders' backyard, basically right next door to his home state of Vermont. But I think Biden needs to have a respectable showing there, or he really could be in some trouble. Already there's signs that his fundraising is a little harder to come by, raising some money that he needs. And so I think these are some critical weeks coming up right now for the Biden campaign.
David, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison, with us for a look at some of the big news in national politics. Coming up Monday on Central Time, once upon a time when the family landline phone would ring, you'd answer it and find out who the call was for. Now that's pretty much gone. Our guest looks at the end of the family landline and how it's changed the way we communicate. That and more Monday on Central Time.